Seeking mental health support? Tune in to What Shape Are You In? The Ultimate Mental Health Show. Expert advice, inspiring stories, and practical strategies. Join us every Wednesday, 4 p.m. Break barriers, challenge stigma. Remember, your mind matters.
Your mind certainly does matter. Thank you for joining us on Unity FM this afternoon in this beautiful sunny day. And I hope you're enjoying the weather and you're also enjoying the program. And again, once again, if you're celebrating Eid, happy Eid. And again, give us a call, 0121-772-8892. We're having a great conversation with Dr. Obs, Dr. Shaquila, and our therapist, Olivia Jones, around the big question for today. Why is it that black and brown men are not accessing mental health services? And we've had great calls, we've had great text messages. A really interesting text message from caller 7711. Please, if that is you, give us a call. We want to hear you. Because I think your question is looking at, like, all right, if the services are right for, if the services are being provided for black and brown men, what about everybody else? Actually, isn't that a question we were asking sort of maybe a couple hundred years ago? We were asking that question a couple hundred years ago. So here we are again asking that question. But however, the data and the research is still telling us that actually black and brown people, even in 2026, are not receiving equitable services. And that's where we want to be. And yeah, let's work together to see if we can make that transition and really start being innovative in how we put our services together. 0121-772-8892. Or if you want to send us a text message, please do that on 07917-137-080. And whilst we were having the break, there's another call that's coming, and I'm going to start right there with this particular call. The caller's name is Alwyn. Alwyn, thank you so much for calling in. It's a shame you didn't come on air, but you know, we can read your message at the same time. So regarding generational trauma, how does it affect us? He says, I'm a black man, descendant of slaves. How does it alter your mind and your DNA? And I think it's been passed down and infected to us mentally from all the, and he uses the word, beatings we got from our parents, which is a really interesting question. And I think, Olivia, I think you might want to kick off with that one. Beatings, discipline, what do we want to call it? Let's Ooh. Call it as the callers called it. I mean, and again, this is a program all by itself, I believe. But Alwyn is suggesting that we've been mentally affected from the beatings that we've had from our parents, or the discipline that, and how our parents may have disciplined us, has affected us mentally.
It's a big question, and I think that question is in two parts, because the text also talked about slavery as well, and alluded to, you know, has emotional pain been transferred from generation to generation. Now, I'm not a researcher, so I would look at Shaquila and Obs for this after, but I do want to talk about a take. And yeah, I mean, isn't this something that we feel viscerally anyway, you know? There's a lot of research out there, not my own, but there's research out there which does suggest that there is some altering of whether it's DNA or whatever that might be, is that we do hold on pain from generations. And it makes sense because, you know, if for histories as a community, as a collective, that we have seen people who look like us be dehumanized, that can that has a deep impact. We, you know, we feel that. So you questioning that makes sense, because you obviously feel that as well, you know. But in terms of the research findings, I guess that's something where I'm very interested whether Obs and Shaquila has found within their theses. And I don't know if that's something you can speak to.
Obs, do you want to help us with that?
Yeah, of course. So I suppose something that came up a little bit, my thesis did not look directly at generational trauma and the impact of it on on the body and the mind. But what it did find was the idea that actually prolonged experiences of racism over time across generations, so parents, grandparents, and so on, probably has impacted the health of the participants that I was seeing as well. So how that might look like is through a term called weathering. So over time, we might take on and adopt some of the similar health conditions that our parents may have had and that our grandparents might have had, because of how racism can impact our physical health. So some of these things include why black people are more likely to have high blood pressure, and are also more likely at times to have compromised immune systems. So when we're thinking about sickle cell and that kind of stuff. So the research has shown that there are links between generational trauma, prolonged experiences of racism, and higher rates of some physical conditions and illnesses. So it's really important that we're bearing this in mind. Just to answer the actual original question as well, another way I think that our generational trauma impacts us across generations and over time is through the idea of trust and hypervigilance. So when people experience PTSD, often PTSD results in symptoms such as being quite aware of your surroundings, quite aware of what's going on, quite switched on, quite on edge, quite nervous. Similar, so for many black people in this country now, when they are in majority white environments, you may notice that you're a little bit more hypervigilant, that you're a little bit more aware of what's going on around you, that you're a little bit more on edge and feeling nervous. That's not a coincidence. That's likely because that would have been how our parents would have felt.
And aren't we equally as hypervigilant around our own communities at times, especially young black men?
Yeah, definitely. When you think about inner city, that hypervigilance is really high. So again, it's not a coincidence that black men are most likely to develop psychosis and also schizophrenia compared to any other population in this country. And it's also not a coincidence that happens mostly in inner city areas as well. So if thinking about being in an inner city area and mixing that with having to be hypervigilant, so looking over your shoulder a lot, like watching your surroundings, looking out for your safety, it's not a surprise that psychosis and schizophrenia is highest within these populations, within these people, because what it means to be a black man around being strong, watching out for yourself, not being seen to be weak, these things, they all combine and interact to increase those rates of psychosis that we're hearing, which often stems from generational trauma.
Wow. Dr. Shakila, yeah.
Yeah, and I just wanted to chime in there, linking back to what we were talking about earlier on, in terms of accessing services and black men not accessing services. They're not accessing services and they're experiencing these symptoms. That means that they're delaying seeking help. And that means the symptoms only just get worse. And then, as you mentioned, Beresford, earlier on, they're often met at crisis point. And that crisis point usually means intervention from the police. Because at that point, if they've not been able to get any help, their expression of whatever emotional pain they may be experiencing may be expressed as violence in their perspective. Or it might be expressed as, we don't know what's going on here. You know, how you're presenting isn't the norm, so we're going to take you away. But I think the work that Olivia is really trying to do is really trying to combat it getting to that point. Really want to avoid getting to that stage, because there is a disproportionate amount of black men accessing mental health services through the criminal justice system.
Yeah, the overrepresentation, I'm going to say, is chronic. As someone who's worked in the system for that long, it's chronic representation. So you're touching on a little bit of behavior. And all right, so there's the clinical side in terms of psychosis and schizophrenia that Obs has mentioned. But in terms of our own community and behaviors and the attitude, the stigma, let's say, that is associated to mental health, means that you can only get help and support at crisis point. So let's try and explore some of the things we might want to do before crisis. Because, again, some of the cases that Olivia's mentioned, these are individuals that not until crisis point, where, yes, the police are called and we know what happens, that ends normally badly, whether with fatality or you get sectioned and then we know how the story goes. So can we start to have a discussion about what do we need to be doing before we get to crisis point in terms of some of our own behaviour, some of our own attitudes, the stigma that's associated to mental health as not only individuals but also communities? What should we be doing before crisis point? Dr. Shakila.
I think there are so many different areas, and I know, Olivia, you're going to touch on some of them as well, but there's one area that I'm really, really passionate about, and I talk about it in many spaces, is that education. Mental health literacy, it's so important. You know, we go to school, we learn English, that is literacy. If you can't name your emotions, if you can't name what's going on in your mind, if you don't have a safe space to do that, if you don't even know that you can access support, if you can't recognize that what I'm feeling in my body doesn't feel right and it's maybe linked to what's going on in my environment or who I'm talking to in my relationships, if you're not able to recognize those things, there's no way that you're going to go and seek help if you don't even know that the help exists, or if you don't even recognize and have that insight into even knowing that you need help. There's a paper that I was reading, and they were looking at Black men and their attitudes and views towards mental health. And one sort of theme that came out of that paper is this idea of detachment. And what the paper suggests is that Black men are often detached from what is actually going on in their sort of cognitive processes and sort of emotional processes as well. And that, again, sort of shows that if you're detached to what's going on in your mind, you're not going to be able to then express that to other people as well, or even get a sense of it for yourself so that you have that insight and that understanding for yourself. So mental health literacy, wherever that starts, whether it's in school, whether it's in the home, whether it's parents being informed about mental health literacy and passing that on to their children, I think that's a very key area and a good preventative method for people, rather than going into sort of restrictive, non-therapeutic environments when it comes to accessing mental health care for Black men.
So, Obs, does your research talk about literacy as well, education?
It does, yeah, yeah. It talks about the importance of literacy and education, and Black people start to become a little bit more aware of what mental health is and means. But actually, there was a new kind of emerging finding in my research that found that actually, many Black people do understand what mental health means now, especially in the young generation, and what many people are doing before they reach crisis point is relying on peer networks a little bit to navigate mental distress. So before we're thinking about referring people to mental health services, actually, how can we utilise the fact that many Black people do believe in that sense of community, do believe in that sense of togetherness, and actually, how can we utilise the peer networks that they already have to support each other? So I had participants in my study that said that brotherhoods that they're in and sisterhoods that they're in have literally saved their lives. So having good brothers and sisters around them have helped them to find the strength to keep going. So I'm thinking that for Black men across the country, across the globe, how can we help them to cultivate a sense of brotherhood where they can lean on others? Equally as well, how can we help third sector organisations to feel more equipped to support Black men as well? So again, before crisis point, before the kind of like traditional NHS services, can we lean on some of these third sector organisations to inform that literacy point of view as well? So can they play a role in educating Black men around what mental health is and what to look out for?
Brilliant. And was your participants from across the country or just from a local area?
So they were from across the country. So there were. So I had three different groups. So I had community members, so people that never accessed therapy before, Black men and women that never accessed therapy before. Then I had professionals, so mental health professionals, and then I also had people from third sector organisations like Black Thrive and others. So it was a mix really in terms of different stakeholders.
Okay, brilliant. And Olivia, For us in the Mental Health Trust, as I said in the beginning, we look after some 72,000 patients across Birmingham and Solihull. But for me, mental health stigma is still one of the biggest challenges I face in trying to do my job, which suggests to me that maybe people don't want to use the service, okay? Which is not a bad thing, because like I've said, if you're only going to use it when you're in crisis, there can be some, you know, other factors that we have to, that we've discussed on this program today. So in terms of what Birmingham Health in Mind are doing, and us as a trust, what else can we do and should be doing when it comes to working with people like OBS and Shaquila to improve our services?
Really big question. And, you know, there's a lot of insight from the research that we've talked about today and beyond that as well. There's many things. I do think it's a layered, there's, you know, speaking from someone from the community, there's certain things as a community we may be needing to lean into. But as a system, as an institution, there's many things that we can be doing. And I think it's really important, and it's something part of the project in terms of improving access for Black Men project, is that we know that not every important conversation about our health of the mind starts in the therapy room. And obviously you was talking about this as well in what you were saying, is that some of these conversations are coming from or facilitated by, I call them community healers. And these are people who are doing the work day in, day out, and creating spaces where Black communities can feel safe. So these are like your barbershops, these are your churches, your mosques, football clubs, gyms, where you can get a sense of brotherhood or sisterhood, choirs, family spaces. And I think we touched on trust being a huge issue in some of our communities. And I think if we, as a service, want to build trust, we have to be willing to step outside the traditional clinical spaces. And it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, lowering our clinical standards. It means recognizing that the relationship often becomes comes before those referrals. So this is something, as a project and as a service, that we are beginning to think about a lot more. And it's really welcomed, you know, and it's backed up by lots of different research as well, like from the Race and Health Observatory report, which recently came out about trauma-informed care, our own strategy, our Birmingham and Solihull mental health strategy, which has come out recently, which looks at this very thing that, you know, why do people have to come into a clinical space? What Shaquila talked about can sometimes feel cold, you know, and talk about their deepest pain. Why can't we bring the therapy to the community? Because there is something about collective healing, particularly within our communities. And obviously talked about like CICs as well. And these are the voluntary sector, for those who might not know, but in Birmingham, there's some amazing, and across the country, amazing people already doing the groundwork. And I think it's around how can we collaborate together? Because we all got the shared goal of wanting to have equitable services. We want people to get support before it gets to crisis. We want to reduce the overrepresentation and underrepresentation, right? So I think that is definitely one area. So using our trusted messengers, our community healers. We also need to improve our communication, I think, and demystify what support means. I often hear within the community, you know, what does mental health mean? Like, actually, what is that? You know, I think sometimes people may think, okay, I get heart palpitations when I have to go to a gathering or something like that. And they're worried that if I talk about it with somebody, they're going to see me as less than, or I might get sectioned. And I know for some people that might feel like, oh, that's not a correspondence. But for some people, it is. So we need to start talking about our health of the mind in a plain language as well. So what is therapy? Because oftentimes, you know, as a therapist, I do have people from our communities and other racialized communities which are completely shocked by who I am as a therapist, that therapists can look like them, sound like them, and can be a space of support. So we need to be able to talk about actually what is therapy and what is talking therapies as well. And I think, you know, over the course of this four-part series, we will hopefully explain that a little bit more. But, you know, for a lot of people, they don't realise that talking therapies is for people, for everybody, you know. Everybody will experience a common mental health problem and, at some point.
And as we're coming to wrap up the programme, again, I just feel that even though we're saying, yeah, we're accessible and there is help out there, and believe me, there's far more help than you know. I know that there are people listening to this program now who are still not convinced. The trust and confidence thing, the detachment that OBS referred to, is really about the people who want and need to engage. And I think we need to do some more work. So I'm just wondering, as a question to both our doctors, really, is there something in the research that tells us about engagement and how important that is? Community engagement. And again, that's part of my role. So I'm constantly reflecting on how I engage communities. So regardless, as much as people saying, actually, you know what, I don't trust this, then let's start to have some conversation about why you don't trust it. And then see how we can get you help. And if the mosques and if the churches or the places of worship, whatever you want to call them, are the most, are the safest spaces, then surely some of those lay ministers, the imams, they have a responsibility as well in terms of how we build trust and confidence. I don't know if that's came out of some of your research, but OBS and Dr. Shakila helped me with that, because that's where our biggest audiences are, whether we like it or not. We need to be talking to those people as well, shouldn't we, in terms of the education piece, you think?
Definitely, yeah. I think in my research, a big thing that came up is people's faith and how many black people are spiritual, religious, have a strong set of faith and values, and many people, rather than turning to therapy services, therapy rooms, people turn to their church, people turn to their mosque, people turn to their place of prayer and worship, people turn to their religious leaders, whether that's their priests, imams, so on and so forth. So I think this is where the gold can be. So helping religious leaders to understand mental health and helping them to understand what mental body stress looks like within our communities, I think is key. So if you can do outreach there more often and more consistently, I think that would be really powerful. And then those religious leaders can play a key role in helping to encourage members of their church, members of their mosque, to step forward into therapy services.
Brilliant.
I think that's how I hopefully see it going.
Yeah. And Shakila, just from your point of view, there's a lack of trust and confidence in our bishops and our imams and our faith leaders, let's say, right across the board. But for those who are doing a good job, how do we begin to engage them so that we can improve their mental health literacy? Because obviously sometimes, or whether we believe that or not, some of the stigma and some of the demonization comes from faith and spirituality. So how do we improve the mental health literacy there, do you think?
Yeah, I think it goes back to what OBS and Olivia has been saying, you know, that sort of linking with the sort of voluntary sector and having those conversations. I think one way is actually understanding what is their point of view right now, what is their position right now, and how do we step in then and provide that education, because they could be coming from, they could have a lot of insight, they could have a lot of knowledge, we don't really know. But I think it's about coming together collaboratively and having discussions and conversations and supporting any, if any, unlearning. You know, there's potentially a lot of unlearning.
Unlearning, absolutely.
If there is a lot of stigma, if there is a lot of resistance, if there is a lot of ignorance, I guess, in a way. And it's about not seeing ourselves as above them, you know, sort of thinking about that power and making sure that there's a balance of power and saying that, hey, like, I see your role, I see your value. I'm here to sort of help you support the community that you serve as well. So I think, yeah, trying to meet them where they're at and not seeing it as this power imbalance. I think that's really key, so that you can build collaborative relationships with the sort of community.
Brilliant.
And voluntary sectors as well.
Fantastic. Olivia, we're coming to the end of the program, would you believe? And just so that listeners know, we are going to be back here on this particular subject matter on the 24th of June, where we'll be taking the conversation much further. But in the last sort of 30 seconds or so, Olivia, where can people get information about how to get the help that they do need?
Yeah. Birmingham Healthy Minds. Okay. Birmingham Healthy Minds, get Google up, type in Birmingham Healthy Minds. If you are a black man and you're interested in seeing content which speaks to your experience and you want to be involved with shaping this as well, we are on Instagram, which is bsmhft.iabm. I do apologize, it is a mouthful. And we also on LinkedIn as well.
Brilliant.
I'm hopefully going to be on other social platforms soon.
Dr. Shakila, Dr. Obs, thank you so much for this conversation, and it's just the beginning, and we're looking forward to the whole series. Olivia, thank you for the work that you do, and to all of you, may your God go with you. Take care, and I'll see you next week.